On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have a full house of expert panel here. We have Mr. Curtis Franklin, Heather Williams, Brian Chi, and we're going to talk about vulnerabilities, data leaks, and how API copyright trolls might be coming for you and more. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 327, recorded February 1st, 2019. Don't feed the API trolls. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Find the right people for your business this year at linkedin.com/thisweek and get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Wasabi's disruptive cloud storage technology is helping enterprises solve one of the fastest growing issues, data storage. See for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial, and use offer code ENTERPRISE. And by Thinkst Canary. Detect attackers on your network with honeypots that can be deployed in minutes. For 10% off and a 60-day money-back guarantee, go to canary.tools/twit and enter code TWIT in the How Do You Hear About Us box. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the heavy artillery, the misfits, the outfit, the brains of this sucker. We have not one, but two, but three enterprise tech professionals today, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, how's it going down there in the swamp?
Lou, it's going well. Our temperatures are finally returning to something like normal. And even though it's gray, it's a warm gray. So it's a fine day to join the Twyatt Riot.
Fantastic. Well, again, we're stacking the deck again today because we're also adding to this winning combo, Miss Heather Williams, Senior Product Solutions Architect at Rutgers Network. Heather, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back again. You guys haven't fired me yet.
Now, are you all set for your latest travels that are coming up in the coming weeks?
Yeah, I just got back from Vegas. I can't say that I'm recovered from that trip yet, but I'm headed to headquarters in California here in a couple of weeks, and then I'll be headed out to Singapore where the chili crabs are waiting for me.
Fantastic, fantastic. Well, folks, remember we have a full house today, and one of those face cards is our geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi, Director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, welcome back, sir. How are you doing down there in paradise?
Thank you. I'm actually wearing long pants because in Hawaii, it's actually cold. We've actually had nights down into mid-50s. And of course, all the people in the northern states are all going, boo, hiss.
That's right. Well, we can't complain, right, with our 50, 40-degree weather. But hopefully things will get warmer soon. Folks, we do have a really great show where we're going to talk a little bit about data leaks, funny laws, exploits, vulnerabilities, and more. But before we get into all that stuff, all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Well, it's not a Friday here in Twyatt without hearing about another data leak or a data dump. Now, really, we hear about the data dumps that show up on the dark web for sale to anyone willing to fork over some Bitcoin. Now, the first large data dump of this year was actually a couple weeks ago, and it was identified by researchers to have 773 million email IDs and 21 million passwords leaked. This time, the Hayso Plattner Institute has identified a new data dump that might have your head spinning. It contains more than 25 billion records of username and passwords from all of your favorite sites out there. Not only that, it did not require you to be part of the infamous dark web to get them. Now, this was just a simple torrent download of data, plus it was posted on a mega upload link and hacker forums. Now, at this point, the data file has been downloaded via torrent more than 2,000 times. That's right. You thought your organization thought you were immune to these dumps. Surprise. If you head over to the Hayso Plattner Institute site right now, they have the data there, and you can provide your email address to find out which passwords you should no longer use in the accounts that were leaked with them. Now, of course, I was curious, and so I checked it out. My Kickstarter account, Dropbox, Tumblr, and Last.fm accounts were exposed, so I have to go change the password there. To note, a couple of them, I actually used the same password. Sorry about that. Bad Lou. Well, my New Year's resolution is to reactivate and proactively and reactively change my security practices and start using those longer, unique passwords for every site. But it might be time for you to do the same. Happy hunting.
So here's a tip. If you're going to use web services, learn how to configure them properly. Rubrik, an enterprise software company focused on cloud data management, has been exposing data related to major customers due to a misconfigured AWS Elasticsearch server. Rubrik was alerted to the issue on January 29th and took the server offline. But because the server lacked password protection, anyone who knew its location could access exposed information dating back to October of last year. Rubrik's full roster of corporate clients and some federal government departments was in the database. The company says the data repository included customer names, business contact information, and support requests in addition to customer support chats. It's ironic to see this happen at Rubrik, an enterprise company providing data services to thousands of major clients, among them the U.S. Department of Defense, U.K. National Health Service and Homeland Security, Deloitte, and Shell.
All rise. Today is a big day for net neutrality. The U.S. Court of Appeals from the District of Columbia is scheduled to hear oral arguments in a lawsuit to overturn the FCC's 2017 repeal of open internet rules. That action means that there's nothing stopping your internet service provider from slowing down access or even blocking certain websites or from charging websites to ensure that users can reach them at faster speeds. Lodging the challenge to this repeal is a group of consumer advocates, 22 state attorneys general, technology companies, all of who are expected to argue that the internet is an essential communication service and as such should be regulated to prevent companies from discriminating against how information travels over their wires. The FCC and internet providers contend that the repeal was legally sound and good for consumers. However, their claims that net neutrality rules kept internet providers from investing in their broadband networks aren't borne out by the numbers. Since the FCC voted to repeal net neutrality, major service providers including Comcast, Verizon, and Charter have all cut broadband network investment, not increased it as the FCC assured us would happen. A ruling isn't expected for months, and even then, this fight could end up in the Supreme Court. Congress is joining in the fight as well, with the new House Communications Subcommittee Chair Mike Doyle vowing to make net neutrality his first hearing. In a story for Slate, April Glazer said it best, quote, "The scary part for consumers is that if ISPs do begin manipulating how we experience the web, it could happen piecemeal, with one free service here and one slower website there, until one day we're all living in a very different web." For now, while the issues work its way through, while the issue works its way through the courts, ISPs do appear to be treading lightly. After all, they're playing the long con.
Real bummer. Undersea cables out in Tonga. Anyway, so the island nation of Tonga lost its primary connection to the internet when an undersea fiber cable was damaged this last Sunday, forcing Tonga to rely on a satellite dish while the country waits for a repair ship to arrive, according to news reports. The outage, which the cable's owners say may have been caused by a ship's anchor, also knocked out overseas phone calls and is hampering money transfers, airline bookings, university enrollments, as well as Facebook connections to family and friends. In the capital, Nuku'alofa, a satellite dish was hastily mounted on Monday to provide limited and slow backup connectivity, prompting hundreds of people to queue outside a government telecom office where the signal is most reliable. Sadly, this is why navigational maps have clearly marked no anchor zones, which are all too often ignored. So while this is rare in that an entire island nation is nearly off the air, anchor drags are all too common, and sadly, deep water cable repair ships are too rare, and such repairs are monstrously expensive.
Now, Bluetooth is shaping up the technology that smart devices are going to use going forward to help devices and organizations interact better. Now, from retail stores, building beacons, to lost keys, to data transfer from device to device, Bluetooth will have a way to make it easier. Now, it's no surprise to hear that the latest minor updates to Bluetooth add some useful features that will also assist manufacturers with better battery life and better features. Now, the Bluetooth Special Interest Group, SIG, announced a new set of standards and features, including a positioning system that can now determine the direction of a Bluetooth signal and where it's coming from. Combining distance and direction, Bluetooth devices can now figure out the precise location of a device down to the centimeter. Now, Bluetooth 5.1 offers two different methods for determining direction, named angle of arrival, or AOA, and angle of departure, AOD. Now, one of the two devices must have an array of multiple antennas, and the data received from those antennas can be used to identify the direction the Bluetooth signal is coming from. Now, if you're going to carrying a smartphone around and the phone has Bluetooth 5.1, a positioning system can have a good idea about your exact location. This could be used to improve navigation indoors, find your lost keys, or enable a smartphone hardware to better pinpoint your location. In addition to that cool and somewhat scary feature, there's also a feature called faster connection initiation, which was added to allow a device to actually not have to service or discover based off their information or generic attribute profile, GAT. It takes time and battery to do that, while now a special caching algorithm will help reduce the time and resources spent doing the search. Now, Bluetooth 5.1 includes several improvements to advertising the signal as well, or the device, where a device can advertise the information of another device, reducing the need of the device to scan and search for it as well. If nothing else, it will be interesting to see what manufacturers do with such technology in the coming months. You may find that a Bluetooth device that powers itself by the microwaves in the air will allow you to never lose your keys and wallet again.
Well, it's a new year, and big DDoS attacks are back in the news. Earlier this month, Imperva mitigated an attack against one of its clients that exceeded 500 million packets per second, making it possibly the largest DDoS attack by packet volume ever recorded. The January 10 attack was a so-called SYN flood, in which an attacker attempts to overwhelm a target computer by sending it TCP connection requests faster than the machine can process them. The attacker sent both a flood of normal SYN packets and a large packet SYN flood involving packets between 800 and 900 bytes at the target using a highly randomized and likely spoofed set of source ports and addresses. Now, attackers often combine these attacks so that the regular SYN packets exhaust the server resources like the CPU, while the larger packets saturate the network. Imperva investigated the January attack and showed that it was launched using two previously known tools, one for the flood of regular SYN traffic and the other for the large SYN attack. The tools appear to have been written by two different individuals and then used in a combined fashion to launch what Imperva is calling, quote, the most intensive DDoS attack against network infrastructure in the history of the Internet, end quote.
Hack me, Mr. Roboto. The Japanese Minister for Internal Affairs and Communications approved an amendment to a technology law in order to make it legal for that government to hack its citizens. Rather than heralding the rise of Big Brother, this move is actually intended to improve security. Staff at the National Institute of Information and Communications Technology, NICT, will use default passwords and password dictionaries to try and hack randomly selected IoT devices and then compile a list of vulnerable devices. They will then report the findings to ISPs, who will be expected to alert consumers and make the devices secure. The five-year survey will start with routers and webcams, but could end up covering more than 200 million IoT devices. With the Tokyo 2020 Summer Olympics and Paralympics around the corner, the Japanese government is concerned about the possibility of a major hack. Major international sporting events have caused cybersecurity alerts in the past, and many IoT products have notoriously lacked security, with 54% of cyber attacks detected in Japan last year involving IoT devices. For example, in just the past few weeks, hacked Nest security cameras have urged owners to subscribe to PewDiePie's YouTube channel and informed others that North Korean intercontinental ballistic missiles were en route to Ohio, Chicago, and Los Angeles. However, there are obvious security concerns, since any successful breach means that the Japanese government could get access to stored data, including webcam images. For those worried, here's an idea. Change your default passwords.
Well, you know what? The government shutdown is having a lot of really interesting and very sad side effects. So, I really don't need to go into the story except to say I told you so. The story goes on to catalog issues like SSL certificates are expiring. In a worker segment already horribly short-staffed, this political argument is going to cost the federal government a huge brain drain from a worker segment already too heavily poached. To back this all up, there are some numbers to back up these concerns. A recent survey by ZipRecruiter of 2,000 furloughed federal workers found that 67% were considering leaving their government jobs to seek work in the private sector. Fewer than 30% felt that the shutdown would end within the next 30 days, and 90% expected significant financial hardship. Now, I personally have been through 4 or 5 federal shutdowns in the last couple of administrations, and they're never easy. But one thing that's really, really different about this one is the previous administrations all made pledges to the federal employees that their back pay would catch up. The Trump administration has been waffling on this. In fact, they've actually been starting to make a lot of noise about, well, you know, if you're a government contractor, we're not going to honor it because you didn't provide services, and so forth and so on. So to the Trump administration, whether or not you're listening to me or not, the reality is cybersecurity specialists and IT specialists don't have to work for the federal government. There is a huge, huge shortage, and especially if those workers are past their 3-year mark where they can take whatever they've earned in their retirement with them, you're probably going to lose them. In fact, I'm even starting to hear rumblings in the industry that other countries are starting to poach on our federal cybersecurity workers. So you know what? My last word, I told you so.
Thanks, Cheever. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up is the bites. But before we do, we have to thank a really great sponsor of this week at Enterprise Tech, and that is LinkedIn Talent Solutions. Now, let me ask you, where are all the professionals at? Well, you know, LinkedIn. It's the world's largest professional network. Some of the biggest names in the industry post content on there every day. I post out their jobs, interests, technology, everything. Plus, I've made some pretty amazing professional contacts using LinkedIn. Now, that goes to show you that LinkedIn can really help your business. Now, post your job where people go every day to make connections, grow in their career, and discover job opportunities. It's LinkedIn. You've used other sites, but they just don't feel right. They're clunky. They don't have the right type of responses. It's just not great. If you think about it, there are 500 million pros on LinkedIn. The advantage that LinkedIn has, it gives you the tools that target the next generation workforce with laser precision. Most LinkedIn members aren't checking job boards regularly, but 9 out of 10 LinkedIn members are open and interested in opportunities like yours. Now, with most U.S. workforce on LinkedIn, posting on LinkedIn is the best way to get your job opportunity in front of the right people. People with the right skills and background for your role who are also ready for something new. Now, it's the best way to find the person who will help you grow your business, and why a new hire is made every 8 seconds using LinkedIn. I've used them in the past, and it's amazing how fast they can actually scale your talent acquisition. Hurry to LinkedIn.com/thisweek and get $50 off your first job post. That's LinkedIn.com/thisweek to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Again, remember, that's LinkedIn.com/thisweek. And we thank LinkedIn Talent Solutions for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump into the bites. We have quite a few of them today. And, you know, anyone who runs a web application or owns a service knows that APIs, or application programming interfaces, are the lifeblood of the thing. Now, without those things, information couldn't flow to and from servers, between services, allow easier for them to actually easily communicate information and automate interactions with applications. Now, how do they I know this? Well, I've built APIs for about 20 years, and I own the Microsoft Office APIs for extensibility. So I can tell you that they're kind of important. Just a bit. Now, this is particular byte takes us back to 2014, where it was widely assumed that no one can use copyright law to restrict APIs use. Now, if there was an API, you could use it unless it was secured and you didn't have access to it. Now, the Federal Court Circuit Appeals Court changed that in 2014. Oracle had sued Google saying that they violated copyright law because they re-implemented APIs from the core Java programming platform or language. Well, the court ruled that they did, in fact, violate copyright law, and this was hallmark. We all know that the purpose of copyright is to encourage creativity, but while software is copyrightable, assigning copyright to a method of accessing that work limits creativity and gives too much control to a copyright holder over its works that are already in the stream of commerce. Now, this week, or this past week, Google is actually petitioning for this judgment to be reversed. The biggest reason is that if APIs can be restricted by copyright, then every single computer program in this world would have to spend money fixing themselves. Plus, there would be a new type of lawsuit coming to the courts from here on out, dubbing it API copyright trolls, and corporations would be able to sue you for using their APIs. Now, I don't think that that's good at all. So I want you, first, before I get onto my soapbox about this, I want to bring you guys in here, starting with Curtis. What do you think here? Is it reasonable to say that an API in which you interact with it and you've used it on your application for a while is now you're not open to be sued for that? You can actually be prevented from using that. Now you have to go change all your software to do that?
Lou, I think that this is one of those cases similar to the many times we've talked about software patents. On the one hand, I don't think that anyone would argue that software is deserving of no legal protection whatsoever, that once you write software, anyone can take your code and use it any way they want. On the other hand, figuring out which of our existing intellectual protections work best for software has been something that we've been struggling with as long as I've been in the industry. And that's, you know, well over 30 years. So on the one hand, I think you're right. If the courts uphold this idea of being able to copyright APIs, it's going to have a profound impact on the industry, because all of a sudden, these interfaces that we thought were there to enable communication between different applications and to enable interoperability between apps, services, and applications would become profit-making and revenue-generating devices. And that's entirely different. On the one hand, I do hope that the courts rule that using copyright to prevent someone from using an API is wrong. And using copyright to prevent someone from including an interface to a service or a program is wrong. On the other hand, I think that at some point, legislatures, and let's be really precise, the federal Congress is going to have to get involved and come up with some way of protecting software-based intellectual property without stifling and destroying all the ways of business that have evolved around current understandings over the past four decades.
Right. Now, I think for me, I mean, obviously APIs make it easier for, you know, software and services to communicate, you for to interact with an app. Now, some of these services, like I think I would say Google is a pretty good example of this. They tend to hide their mode of operation by either encrypting it or using different protocols like protobufs to make sure that the data going over the wire is hard to distinguish. And so people really can't use those APIs. They can't really determine what's going on because things are kind of hidden away. But, you know, if people try to use them, they couldn't because they just didn't know how to. But, you know, now they're saying if people figured it out, you know, they might want compensation for that. Now, Google is obviously going against this, but we're saying that other organizations could possibly do this, like Oracle and so on. Now, Cheebert, I want to throw this over to you. APIs are used in networking and IT industry all over the world. Now, what if Cisco said one day, hey, we're now going to charge you for you to use our APIs for your tools, and we'll sue you if you don't pay? What would you do?
I'm actually going to go with the nuclear option and say, hey, no, I can't do it anymore. The reality is APIs are so interwoven into the current, you know, the modern internet, that if all of a sudden we had to pay to use them, we might as well go back to the World Wide Web of 1989, 1990, back when Tim Berners-Lee at CERN invented the World Wide Web. It had no connectivity. Heck, it wasn't even really able to display even pictures, because pictures require an API, you know, to show off different types of, you know, compression. And the reality is, you know, we need APIs. APIs are so, so important. Amazon needs them. All your shopping, anyone that goes and tries to buy a airline ticket nowadays is using a whole set of APIs. Heck, even places like, say, United or any of the major airlines are actually using a whole lot of APIs, that, you know, a little travel app, so you can use your app so you can log in. Well, there's an API to generate those QR codes. So my opinion is, yeah, Cisco, Amazon, everybody. APIs are so integral to the internet that if the court case is upheld, kiss it goodbye. That's my opinion.
Right, right. Agreed. Now, Heather, I want to throw this over to you as well, because, you know, you work in the land of Wi-Fi, and tools in IT, they use APIs to, they would be useless without these things. Now, if they were now copyrighted, my guess is prices would skyrocket, and if companies weren't wise and didn't actually pay up, they could be open to attacks. Is this something that would affect that industry as well?
Yeah, it actually hits me where I live in a couple of places. To go back to what Brian's point was, as soon as he had me at Amazon. Anything that means that I don't have to interact with an actual live human being any more than I have to gets a thumbs up for me. So I don't window shop. I use Amazon. They've got my attention on this. But to more to your point, and I'm not a coder or a programmer. I use the APIs, but I only know a little bit about how the behind the scenes work for them. We can't do our jobs without these OS tools and these Wi-Fi tools. And on one hand, some of them, because they're very specialized and they sort of have you, some of these are hugely expensive already. To make them more expensive would be a problematic. I think we'd end up having to go to, we'd be back to the backpack full of individual devices. Nothing would be integrated. So trying to make reports or get anything, get real useful information is going to be a real problem. I would like to do a shout out in the Wi-Fi world. The grandfather of all and a hero to our industry, Adrian Granados, he does tools that he almost essentially gives away. So if this affected him, it would all of that would go away. And these are tools that I use every single day, even out here in the middle of nowhere.
So I think I want to throw this back over to Kurt for his last word, because I think you have some information about cases in the EU about this, right?
Well, it's about something that's very similar. And it's in the same way that APIs have become an accepted way of connecting programs, URLs are the way we get from place to place on the web. There's been an interesting set of cases that are working their way through in Europe that basically go this way. In the U.S., if you just link to something, you're fine. I mean, you can use a URL to link to a page that someone has without asking their permission, without giving them compensation. In Europe, there's a recent case that says that if you're doing that to a free website, you're fine. But you can't just link to a paid site without their permission and without giving them the opportunity to see revenue from it. You know, this in some ways is like the publications in the U.S. that have paywalls. There are a few of these where it's well known that you have a certain number of articles you can read per month free. But if you follow the link that someone gives you in, say, a Facebook post or a tweet, that doesn't count against your total, basically allowing you to game the system and read more than the paywall would allow. Well, according to the URL cases in Europe, that wouldn't be allowed. It's, again, it's tweaking this idea of what we have thought of as a free interface, a free mechanism, and saying that commerce, that the rights of the owners of that intellectual property outweigh the rights of those who would use it or access it. We're going to see a lot of this, I think, over the next couple of years as we go through another wave of litigants and courts trying to figure out just where the line should be drawn and exactly how the laws developed to deal with things like print, spoken word, and television should deal with the internet.
Fantastic. Well, Kurt, I think we'll go ahead and jump into your next bite here about Cisco routers.
Yeah, we had an interesting case over the last couple of weeks. And basically, it was like this. Cisco has a series of routers designed for the small to mid-sized business market, the RV320 and RV325. They're dual gig port routers. A fairly profound vulnerability was discovered in these routers. They have, as we were just talking about, a web-based management interface. And researchers found that if you sent a very specific URL request to this interface, it would spill its guts. It would give you all of the configuration information, which included things like the admin account name, the admin password, the MAC address, the certificate, all kinds of stuff, with no encryption, no further need for authentication, no nothing. This was a very bad thing. So this was disclosed responsibly. It was researched well. And Cisco did the right thing. They remediated the problem through a software patch that they put out there. That should be everything. But where I came into the story over at Dark Reading was when another set of researchers at a company called Rapid7 started doing some verification work on this. And they followed it up and they found that there were some other interesting things about this. One of the things was there were some discrepancies between just how many exposed devices there were between the original researcher and what they found. Now, it wasn't a huge difference, either in absolute numbers or in magnitude. Same magnitude, but there were some differences. Why? I mean, if you go out and you do something like a Shodan search, shouldn't three people doing the Shodan search end up with the same number of results? Well, maybe, maybe not. And there are a lot of reasons for that. But it's interesting talking to the researchers and seeing what they find. Now, one of the interesting things that I was able to find out about this were the tools that they use. And let's be honest here. Pretty much every security company has their own active scanning system and passive system. At Rapid7, those are called Sonar, Project Sonar for the active, and Project Heisenberg for the passive. And from their standpoint, the passive basically is a series of about 200 honeypots that they've got scattered around the world. It was interesting using this as a great example because it was able to show some other things. Like, if you're familiar with the addressing system, you know that an IP address can be referencing an interface or a device, or in some cases, an entire network where you then do network address translation or NATing to get to an entire network behind the single outward-facing address. MAC, or as a user referred to, MAC addresses, are different. A MAC address, a MAC, refers to or is assigned to one interface. So, you know, as an example, if you've got a device that has both a gig Ethernet port and a Wi-Fi radio, you're going to have at least two MACs in that device. If you've got Bluetooth, if you've got other, most laptop computers have somewhere between three and half a dozen MACs assigned to them. So MACs are all supposed to be unique. What the Rapid7 folks found was that there was a block of about 1,200 devices sharing one MAC. Now, why is this? Well, turns out this was probably a supply chain issue where a single supplier had supplied all of these interfaces to Cisco a decade ago. And through some mechanism, whether it was a flaw in their manufacturing or just laziness, rather than giving each one of those gig ports a unique MAC, they just did copy and paste, gave them all the same MAC. This is not a huge problem unless you're, say, law enforcement trying to use the MAC to locate something, or you end up with a pair of these devices on the same network. You have multiple devices with the same MAC. It can give you some real problems with network performance. Although, in the words of the researcher I talked to, this is a noisy problem. It's not something that tends to be real subtle. It tends to be a hard fail. So the thing that I thought was fascinating about this was that it showed the way that these security researchers build on one another's work in the same way that researchers in the scientific fields confirm one another's research and build on that research. And it showed how we get to some of these really interesting oddball discoveries that we tend to see. Now, in my part of the world, where I'm having all kinds of researchers and their companies send notes to me every day, you get all sorts of little weird things coming across my desk. This is a good example of how that could happen. I'm interested in talking to my co-host here because I think each one of them is going to have an interesting point of view on this. And Mo, I want to turn to you first because you deal with setting up these networks on pretty much a day-to-day basis. What would you think if all of a sudden you were going through setting up a network, doing an inventory, and you started seeing a number of devices with the same MAC sitting there on the network? Would you, first of all, would that strike you as unusual?
Well, I think hard fail was the best line there. Frankly, it would be such a hard fail and so completely weird that I would question my sanity. I at that point, I would be doing a phone a friend saying, it's got to be me, right? I in the chat box, I said, talk about the mother of all copy paste fails. How do you end up with 12,000 of given that the OUI is, it's in the name, unique identifier.
Well, to me, it was fascinating because one of the things, you know, if they had said these were all devices that showed up in a developing nation where the odds were pretty good that some enterprising thief had grabbed one device and had sat down and just literally done a copy and burned new copies of that. It wouldn't have surprised me. But these were all over the world, and the majority of them they found in North America, in the United States. And that just shocked me. And the other thing that surprised me was that this wasn't even what they were looking for. So Chibert, I want to turn to you and ask the question, how often do you start looking for one thing and end up finding out interesting things that aren't even related to your original target?
Probably every single forensic investigation I've ever done. It's happened a lot. And I'll tell you, the last time I ever heard of something like this happening was when Ethernet cards were brand new and they were running about $1,000 each. This is back in the real early 80s. And one of the colleges here at the University of Hawaii got a whole couple cases of Ethernet cards because they were going to do the entire college. And we sat around scratching our heads going, why the heck isn't anything working? It took us almost 2 weeks to finally figure it out. And we broke down and got out this, in those days, really, really, really expensive piece of equipment called a sniffer and started looking at the packets and going, holy, we had never seen so much traffic from a single card. And then we started unplugging things. We still had the same MAC address. And it took all day not believing what we were seeing to finally figure out that we had 200 Ethernet cards all with the same MAC address. And we found out what it was is a mainland Chinese company had stolen a U.S. Ethernet card design and just wholesale duplicated it. To answer your question, if I ever do see things like that, one, I don't believe my eyes. I'd be in the same situation as Mo. And then the second thing I would do is I'd say, okay, whatever company did this is now in the sin bin. I will never buy gear from them again because this is a real, real amateur move.
Well, I agree with the amateur move, and this is something that I have not seen coming from other manufacturers. But, another part of this was on the configuration side. When the researchers were looking at these devices, it's one thing to say that they were exposed to the Internet, and basically that means they had a port that was visible to the Internet. It was another thing to say that they were vulnerable, which meant that through a relatively straightforward process, you could get into that interface. And that often involved doing things like using the default user or admin account and password. Lou, I want to turn to you because you are involved in developing software on a significant enterprise level. We see so many cases of both hardware and software where either the developers hard code admin user account and password, or they make it difficult to find and change one or both of those bits of information. So from your perspective, how much more difficult is it from a software development standpoint to build in a good, secure account and password routine versus just hard coding something stupid that anyone with a Google account can find and get into?
So any type of authentication loop it's usually, depending on what type you're doing, it requires a bunch of different services and facets of the system to be able to secure it. Because a lot of times you have to send in your credentials that are encrypted in some way, and then that's kind of gone to some kind of identity authority that will then verify that. And then it'll tell the service you're trying to talk to or the application you're trying to talk to that you're authenticated, and they'll let you in, and they'll give you some kind of special token that you can then reuse over time, and that at some time will expire, and then you can reacquire it. So there's like, that's normally like a normal flow that you'll see around the web. And so being able to kind of implement that is sometimes really hard to do. Like, I think that's one of the number one time sinks in software development, or whether it's on hardware devices or not, is implementing a good authentication and authorization loop in it, which is a lot of times why hardware vendors and companies don't do it. So I think, you know, some of the responsible ones out there will, because they know they have to be compliant in most places, but some of them won't. In this case, we've even heard that there's been authentication loops using things like MAC addresses. And the problem is with MAC addresses, even though the data might be encrypted over the wire, the MAC address isn't. So using that in your authentication loop is just a really bad idea, because people can spoof these things and they can get in and they can authorize themselves as well. So I think that in this case, it's just a really lazy thing. I think I was saying in the chat room, I think there's something like 280 trillion possible combinations of MAC addresses out there. So saying that they've copied and pasted these just seems like a really lazy thing, almost like it was just a mistake in some case when they one of their EEPROMs were programming and they ended up copying and pasting the wrong thing or something. So I can't imagine they did this on purpose, but I hope not, at least. But again, it's something that is, authentication is usually one of the biggest things. So if you're developing software and it's time for you to add authentication, make sure you estimate quite well, because otherwise it will definitely be one of those things that will lengthen your delivery for sure. Well, folks, we're going to get into some more bites, but before we do that, we do want to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Wasabi. Now, you know, I've used Wasabi, and they're so awesome, because you might have saying, hey, I've cloud storage, but it's really expensive, because the more you store in it, the more you pay. Well, sometimes that's true, but with Wasabi, this day and age, they found a way to get around that. Now, most competitions these days, they basically say, hey, how low can we go with these fees? Because they could, with storage fees and what they call ingress and egress fees, so how many times you actually access your information, they'll try to go as low as possible. Well, Wasabi Cloud Storage has blown people's minds here, because they figured a way around that. They actually do something where they only cost $4.99 per terabyte per month. But listen to this game changer: unlimited free egress for your data. That means that there's no charge for accessing your data, those API calls. So you don't actually pay to have to deal with that. Go check out it right now, because you're probably already paying for this on your cloud storage. You're paying much more to store it, as well as a lot of money to actually access it, because not including those egress fees or those API calls, those CRUD operations, will really substantially save you a lot of money. So go check it out right now, because I know that you're probably paying for it right now. Now, you're probably thinking, well, if they're cheaper, they must be slower too. Well, that's not true. They actually offer not only really fast speeds with a lot of performance, but also a lot of features. Wasabi has developed a disruptive technology. They found ways to pull raw performance out of their storage devices without compromising anywhere else. They have a revolutionary process that lays data down what they call sequentially, as opposed to in blocks. And what happens is that makes Wasabi's storage 80% cheaper and 6 times faster in speed than some of the industry leaders. And if your organization is actually worried about compliance, well, Wasabi has you covered with HIPAA, FINRA, CGIS compliancy as well. Now, fast, cheap storage isn't really worth much if your data isn't secure. Well, Wasabi has an answer. Wasabi offers a unique feature of immutable buckets that cannot be deleted or altered, protecting your valuable data from accidental or malicious destruction. Now, see if you can find another service out there that's doing that today. Plus, they have a 90-day rotation on their integrity checks and 11 nines of durability. Now, if you're worried about, well, I have to actually migrate my data to the cloud, that's going to take a while. Well, Wasabi has an answer for that as well. They have what they call the Wasabi Ball Transfer Appliance, and this is powered by Netgear, and it's designed to transfer super large data sets while dramatically reducing your cost. Now, you might already have cloud storage today, or your organization's tried to store data on-premise to save money, or wants to partially move to the cloud. Well, with Wasabi, they might actually have you rethinking that approach. I bet you want to try this out right now. So go build something and try something and build something on Wasabi today. Experience Wasabi for yourself with free unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com. click the free trial link and enter the code ENTERPRISE. See how much storing in the cloud can save your business. That's wasabi.com and enter the code ENTERPRISE. We thank Wasabi for their support in this week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's go ahead and jump back into the bites. And this time, Cheebert has a pretty good one here. I'm going to throw it over to you, Cheebert.
Okay, so PG&E is in trouble. So the headline is basically major utility implicated in more than a dozen wildfires files for bankruptcy. And PG&E is looking at getting out of power purchase agreements to cover the looming debt. Okay, so this bite actually isn't about the PG&E bankruptcy. No. There's some fallout that's going to start happening. It's going to be interesting. It's going to really affect the rooftop solar business, and it's going to affect almost all the sustainable energy providers in the United States. So anyway, here's what I'm kind of coming up. So basically, PG&E is being held responsible for these fires because of either poor maintenance, or in one story, it's actually talking about, well, they followed the maintenance standards to the letter, but are the maintenance standards good enough? And so this brings me into my wheelhouse, and that's sustainable energy. There is one thing that we've been talking about ever since Dan Geer did a keynote for Black Hat, saying that the true edge of the internet is actually in the residents. California is even starting to talk about having standards for residential, you know, non-commercial or light commercial firewalls, or actually they call them security devices. Anyway, the point I'm making is if a utility is being held responsible and people are saying, well, they did the right thing, but maybe we need to go and change the regulations so we will actually go and say, hey, you got to do a little bit more. You got to do a lot more to prevent your equipment from sparking. Because trust me, because it was so dry in high winds, high voltage lines sway next to each other. They can't touch typically, but they can sway next to each other. And when you're talking about hundreds of thousands of volts, you will actually cause an induction, and power will actually leap between the lines. Here in Hawaii, we've had that a lot. We have a lot of these what we call transcoolau, so they're going over the mountain range, and they're high voltage lines because there is no power generation on the windward side of the islands. So everything has to go over the mountain. When we get up over like 30 or 40, 50 miles an hour winds, sometimes we start getting blackouts. Hawaiian Electric has a really, really light finger on the trigger. And when they start getting these big spikes, they actually will shut down major portions of our power generation. So now I'm finally getting to my point. When we start talking about rooftop solar, the problem with rooftop solar is you're getting into having to feed power back. Now, keep in mind, a lot of places, you know, like the Campfire and so forth in Northern California, you have relatively old power distribution. So they're designed to go one way from the provider out to the neighborhoods. When you start having rooftop solar, now you've got to have the power coming back. Well, here's the problem. If you have older infrastructure feeding power back to the substations and then possibly the substations feeding it back into the distribution grid, you start getting into places where you're going to overload things. So in the industry, there's a process called curtailment. And right now, most of the utilities out in the world have an all or nothing arrangement. So if you have rooftop solar and the grid's starting to get overloaded, they'll actually shut you down. So there has to be a method of controlling. So right now, a lot of these guys are using cellular. And they'll use cellular and then use Zigbee to hop around. it scales to a point. But now a lot of people are saying, well, why don't you just be able to go and set it up so that we can do marginal curtailment? There's actually an industry standard called SunSpec. It allows you to do marginal or fractional curtailment. So instead of doing an all or nothing, wouldn't it be great that I could say, okay, we're only a little overloaded. I'm going to curtail this neighborhood 10% so that we don't go and burn up the transformers and cause fires like we had in Northern California. But here's the problem. When you start feeding this information using residential Wi-Fi or residential cable modems or DSL modems or what have you, now you start saying, are we providing an insecure path back into the utility? That's the big issue. So anyway, what's going to happen here is I'd like to kind of get your opinions. Kurt, this one's for you. How much are we, do you think we're providing these back paths? Do you think that we're ready for it? Do you think we need more regulation? Is this something that there's been enough conversation about? Just what do you think?
Well, I don't think there's been enough conversation because I think that there's been at the level of the public utility commissions where this sort of thing happens, I think there's been very little discussion at all. In terms of regulation, I do think there should be more. I mean, let's look at the way that public utilities exist in the United States in virtually every place. You have public utilities that are de facto, if not actual, monopolies. You have one company that brings the cables to your house that carry electricity. Obviously, if you're off grid, things change. But right now, that's such a small percentage. We're going to pretend that they don't exist. So you've got monopoly power, and in return, the public utility commissions have said, all right, you won't have any competition, but we're going to limit how much profit. You know, we're going to guarantee you a profit, but only so much profit. And in return, you have to do things for the public good. I think that in many places over the past dozen years or so, we've seen the pendulum swing more toward guaranteeing greater profits and less toward guaranteeing public good. I think there needs to be a rebalancing there. Obviously, being able to do these back channels is one. There are all sorts of other things. I mean, to be brutally honest, I would include hardening of cyber systems to be something that needs to be done because we've already got proof that hackers are into the grid throughout much of the country. So definitely I'm on the side of greater oversight, more regulation, and more development and progress for that profit that the utilities insist on being guaranteed.
Well, folks, when we come back, we want to talk a little bit more about this. We also want to get Heather's thoughts on this because I know she's been chomping at the bit here. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Canary. Now, we all know that hackers take the path of least resistance. I always say your organization's only as secure as your weakest link. And what is your weakest link? Well, your users, of course. Now, in fact, being that in that mindset of assume breach, your organization will be better off because it takes an average of 191 days for a company to realize that there has been a data breach. Now, that's kind of a stat that comes from the wild, and that's an increasing number of data breaches each and every year, and it's time to go on the defense, and that's where Think Canary steps in. These honeypot appliances are super cool. You spread a couple of these devices on your network, and when there's a breach, you will be alerted almost immediately. Back in the early 2000s, people talked about using honeypots, but they weren't easy to deploy and use. Now, Canary has made this simple with zero administration and managing overhead. Canaries can be set up in under 4 minutes with basically your configuration, all you need. Your Canary will look like an identical to a router, a switch, a NAS server, a Linux box, or a Windows server. Attackers can't tell the difference. Now, thanks to the company behind Canaries has been fighting back in security game for over 2 decades. They're training companies, militaries, and governments on how to break into networks, and they've used this experience to build Canary. Now, you might think, well, hackers are going to know these things are honeypots and stay away from them. Not at all. Things Canary, they don't actually look like, they look like a vulnerability on your network. They look valuable. They look like the real thing. You can put fake files on them. You can even enroll them in Active Directory. These devices are extremely valuable to fight against security breaches. Not only are they a great value, but they're licensed annually, and if they break down during that year, Thinx will actually replace them. Now, since they're priced well, you can start with a few and scale them up over time. Some of the largest organizations in the world use these Canaries on their networks, and I think it's time for you to get that value as well. Don't end up on this year's list of top 10 data breaches. Visit canary.tools/twit for just $7,500 per year. You get 5 Canaries, your own hosted console, upgrades, support, and maintenance for a full year. And we have a special offer for our audience. Use code TWIT in the How Did You Hear About Us box to get 10% off the price for life. We are sure you'll love your Thinx Canary, but if you're not happy, you can always return your Canaries with their 2-month money-back guarantee for a full refund. That's canary.tools/TWIT and enter the code TWIT in the How Do You Hear Us box. And we thank Canary for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Well, folks, we're going to get back into the bites here. And we're talking about Cheebert's bite here, but we did want to get the thoughts from Mo. So, Mo, we'll throw it over to you.
Thanks. And when we had to do the commercial break to keep me from spluttering, I had to get myself under control before we started with this. So one of the things that I noted in his story, there's a quote that says that they're under too much debt load because they gave higher rates for the buybacks for those early adopters. And I just have to ask, am I the only one who's ever played Monopoly? I mean, getting the utilities is a great way to win the game. So I'm having a hard time feeling sorry for these guys. They're worried about paying these early adopters who paid a fortune for their systems. We're talking about the solar systems and other renewable resources in an age when everybody except the current administration understands that coal is not coming back and that we really do need to have alternative forms of energy. I don't know why we would be going in the other direction and not supporting that. There's another question about how would this affect co-ops. And like a lot of the country, that's how I get my power is through an electrical co-op. If are we going to be asking these co-ops to have to go through and upgrade their systems and pay a lot of money out of pocket? And are these rural co-ops, do they have the resources and the pockets to deal with that? While you were doing the commercial, I did a quick Google. 56% of the U.S. landmass is covered by a rural co-op. So that's a tremendous amount of the country that could go dark if we don't come up with a better answer to this. I got it under control. So I'm.
Thanks, Mo. That was great. But you know what? I'm going to bring this back a little bit because this really is talk. This whole bite is really about liability. So the point we're making is PG&E seems to have done the letter of the regulation on maintenance, types of equipment, protections, and things like that. But yet there's still being held liable for an amazing amount of debt from these lawsuits. Now, I'm not going to feel really, really, really sorry for PG&E. There's a lot of interesting things in that court case, and I'm not going to pretend to be a lawyer, especially one with a public utilities commission. But it does kind of make me ask, if that huge amount of power is being provided by co-ops, and co-ops typically aren't swimming in money, will these new regulations that are being driven by this lawsuit going to affect the cost of producing energy in America to the point where co-ops might not be viable anymore? Are we creating a world of just massive utilities? Is Mr. Trump playing Monopoly with the United States of America is my big question. There's going to be a lot of interesting things. And when you start having these kinds of liability questions, you're actually working against renewable energy, because now all of a sudden renewable energy hasn't been economically viable. It needs to be subsidized at the moment. But when you start throwing additional regulations on there, is that going to kill some of the renewable energy efforts? You know, when you start curtailing, you know, like for instance, on the island of Maui, when we have to curtail the wind farms, where does that extra energy go? So at the moment, a lot of it's actually being thrown away. But where does it need to go? Well, it needs to go into grid-tied batteries. And actually, I saw a presentation just a couple weeks ago about using curtailed energy to produce hydrogen, and using hydrogen fuel cells for buses and, you know, long haul truck and so forth seems to be a really, really interesting alternative. So liability wise, I think we've got to proceed carefully when a utility is done what they say and investigators say is the letter of the law. Do we really want to hit that kind of, you know, hit utilities that hard, because that's going to have some real negative impacts on renewable energy. And yes, CR1, no, it's a simple battery, yes and no. But when you start talking about grid-tied batteries, you have to maintain a lot of quality on the power. And Rocket 88, literally the way you produce hydrogen is you pump clean water, you know, they got to filter the water into a special stack. They call it a stack. And you pump a lot of electricity in there and it splits the hydrogen. You pull that off and you put it under high pressure. We've got a couple of hydrogen demonstrations here where we're running buses around some of the military bases and, you know, on the different islands. And it's actually, in some cases, most cases, safer than gasoline, and you can refill a hydrogen bus a heck of a lot faster than you can lithium ion batteries, and the efficiencies are really, really high. So anyway, this has been Cheebert's Soapbox, and I think it's time to close down the show. What do you think, Lou?
Sounds good to me. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe, according to 9 out of 10 API copyright trolls. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-hosts in crime, the brains of this output, starting with Heather Williams. Thank you again for being here. I know, especially after all of your long trips, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, you can get me online at on Twitter at MoBetterWiFi.
Fantastic. Thanks again for being here, Mo. Of course, we have to thank our favorite journalist, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your great work?
Well, my writing can be found, as usual, at darkreading.com. I've got an interesting thing that I'm working on right now on times when encryption might not be the best idea. I'm curious from our quiet listeners, is there a time when you think encryption should not be the answer? Drop me a note on Twitter, KG4GWA, or to my email account at ubm.com. Also, I had a piece this week on things you should know if you're getting into access control lists, so you can build up your ACL intelligence. Come on over, check me out at darkreading.com.
Fantastic. Thanks, Chris. I need to build up my ACL intelligence. Of course, we never want to forget our loyal producer and everyone's favorite geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chee. Brian, where could the folks at home find you and all of your great work?
On Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, like you see in that bottom third. Or I am Cheebert at twit.tv. Yes, indeed, I have been getting some of your questions. Some of them are actually asking for free consulting. I'll play that game for a little while. But anyway, keep in mind, I try not to backseat driver your boss. So sorry, I'm not going to go and give you ammunition to go against your boss. Sorry, not going to do that. But I'd love to hear from you anyway. So I am Cheebert at twit.tv, or better yet, use Twit at twit.tv and hit all the hosts.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have to also thank you because you're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise news. Go to the show page right now to twit.tv/Twit. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, plus all the show notes, co-host information, guest information, and more. And right next to that really fancy video that you're seeing there, you'll also get those helpful download and subscribe links to support the show by getting an audio version of your choice, video version, HD video version, and listen on any one of your devices. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you're subscribed, go ahead and share the show with your friends and your coworkers. I find I share with a lot of my coworkers at work, and they really find it helpful to keep it up on their enterprise goodness. So go ahead and share with your friends and family and coworkers as well. Of course, if you're going to watch the show, you can come actually watch the show live, because remember, we do the show live every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays. So come actually watch the show live. And if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the great chat room where we have some really great questions from the show, and we kind of veer the network and veer the show based off those questions. So that's irc.twit.tv to drop in and talk to us while we do the show. Of course, don't forget, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. Go check that out, because I like to post my daily ramblings out there, as well as a lot of the stuff that I'm working on. Of course, you can always check out my work at Microsoft at dev.office.com, where you can find all the latest, greatest stuff on how to extend Office and make it work for you and make it more productive. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support us each and every week. And it's really great we can continue to doing this week in enterprise tech because of them. I also want to thank everyone and all the engineers at Twit for all their great work. And of course, Mr. Brian Chee, who is our producer, who gets all the great guests on, gets all the content. Really do appreciate for his help and his continuing support. Of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Victor. Victor, again, tradition, we have to ask you, what was the main theme that you got out of the show today?
Wow.
So you're in the dark over there. You gotta get in the light.
I'll try for next week.
Okay.
So
all right, maybe next time.
I guess I learned that all four of you guys have a lot to say when you do a soapbox show.
This is true, but no, I think that was not the main thing. But what I would say is stop. The main thing would be stop using God as your password, okay?
Oh, okay.
All right. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.